Alright guys, let's make a start. You've probably had enough of me talking to you over the last few weeks, so I'm going to shut up actually for the next few weeks. I'm not giving the next a few lectures, but today we're very privileged to have three guest speakers who are, you know, leading people in the field. And I won't say too much, so I'll let them introduce themselves a little bit and tell you about their work. But the main aim of this, I asked them basically to talk about how they went about doing the research. Okay, so hopefully the aim is that that will help you when you're doing your case studies for the second years this term and for the third years next term. So basically they're going to ask to talk for a few minutes now, talk about their research, how they did that, and then there'll be time for some questions and answers at the end. Okay, so if there are things that they say on the way through, make a note of it. I'm hoping we'll have about 10-15 minutes at the end for some questions and answers. And I will pass over to, let me introduce them very quickly. We have Megan Daigle on the right-hand side as you're looking at it. My good friend Sophie Harmon in the middle, and Matt Watson on this hand side. I'll pass over to Megan.
All right, so I'm going to stand up here so I can flick through my slides. Can everyone hear me? Yeah? Okay. So I'm going to be talking to you today about my PhD research project, which, as you can see, is now a book called From Cuba with Love, Sex and Money in the 21st Century. The book centers on the figure of the jinetera, which is a uniquely Cuban word that means a woman who dates and sleeps with foreigners, presumably for some kind of material gain. And this is a phenomenon and an identity that has captured both Cuban and international attention in the last 25 years. I'm going to distract you with some photos while I talk a bit. The jinetera emerged in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, when Cubans came up against an economic crisis that was far worse than the Great Depression. Salaries and supplies of food dwindled, and Cubans had to find new ways to make ends meet. So they fixed and mended things where they otherwise might have thrown them away. They created new businesses to fill the gaps and needs around them. And when the government opened the country up to international tourism for the first time in decades, Cubans began interacting with foreigners again as tour guides, taxi drivers, waiters, and souvenir sellers. And some Cubans began to embrace sex, love, romance with tourists as a means of survival and escape. Beginning around 1996, the Cuban state responded to what it deemed a resurgence of prostitution with a sweeping program of repression that includes mass arrests, a heightened police presence, rehabilitation centers, and other surveillance measures. Together, the police force, the Ministry of the Interior, and the Federation of Cuban Women created an atmosphere of fear, not only for these women, the jineteras, but for any woman who fit the popular understanding of what counted as a jinetera. So a young, attractive, Afro-Cuban or mixed race woman. And this subjection to state control was compounded by abuse by police officers, middlemen, and sometimes even their own partners and families. The book makes the case that Cuba's reaction to jineterismo as a social and a sexual practice shows up holes in its egalitarian ethos, and that it relates directly to discourses of Cuban national identity and security on an international stage. It tells us something important about Cuba's place in the world and how it fits into global economies of tourism and migration. So that's a quick summary, and that's where I wound up with the project. But now I'm going to walk you through the process itself. Because I didn't begin this project by knowing where I was going to wind up or what I was going to write about. In fact, I began this project by very nearly quitting. I was 3 months into my PhD. Things seemed to have fallen apart. I'd lost the house I was living in. My supervisor left for a different university, and I was completely uninspired by the research I'd proposed, which was something much broader on political participation in women in Cuba. I met with my new supervisor, and I told her I was going to quit. And she said, go away, take a month, read anything that sparks your interest, come back, and we'll see what that tells us. So I did, and what I discovered was that what I needed was a way in, an entry point to my topic. I knew I was interested in Cuba because of its unique position in the world. Cuba means so many things to so many people. It's an exotic island with rum and cigars. It's a repressive and secretive regime that's founded on the theft of assets from Americans. It's an egalitarian paradise, free from racism and sexism. Cuba is in many ways a fantasy. And I also knew I was interested in gender and race and how they interact with international politics. So what I wanted to do was to dig deeper into those claims of gender and racial harmony in Cuba, to pull them apart and see how they worked. So I read and I read and I took notes. And finally, I came across a special issue of a journal on the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution and a rather vague reference to quinetarismo, and I found my case. It brought together all the things I was interested in: gender, race, sexuality, surveillance and control, socialist ideology. And it was a hard case that would grant me a window onto the Cuban Revolution's progressive claims. So very early on, it became clear to me that the only way to find out what the effects of Cuba's reaction and crackdown on the quinetarists would be to do an ethnographic study of Cuba, to go to Cuba. So to prepare for that experience, I spent several months surveying the existing literature, all the things that intersected in my project. So Cuban politics and history, gender in Cuba, sex tourism around the world, different ways of thinking about sexuality and commercial sex, feminist politics. I also set myself the task of learning everything I could about field research methods, and there's a lot out there. How to do interviews, how to take observations, record data, analyze materials. And finally, I spent a long time attending workshops and conferences, getting in touch with people who'd done extensive research in and on Cuba. I mean, that's what they're there for. They also gave me pointers on very practical matters about going to Cuba, how to get a visa, how to find a place to live, how to use public transportation. It doesn't come easily in a place like Cuba. And the network I managed to build stretched from the UK to Cuba itself. And then the next stage, of course, is fieldwork. Or, as I like to call it, recognizing that my research is never going to turn out the way I've expected it to. I mean, we can sit at our desks and formulate our research questions and our plans, but field research has ideas of its own. I spent 6 months living and working in Cuba continuously, and I found that fieldwork answers a lot of questions, but it also raises a lot of its own questions, and some of those will persist throughout the research and beyond. Some of mine were, well, first of all, what or who was I actually studying? When I got there, I realized if I picked people out based on looking like a jinetera, based on race, age, appearance, I was doing the exact same thing the police were doing, which was profiling people. And on a related note, how could I reach out to potential informants? We learn a lot in research methods about sampling, delineating a field, and those are important ideals for good research, but they are ideals, and sometimes they aren't possible in real-life settings. You'll be unsurprised to learn there's no union of jineteras with membership cards, there's no lists to consult. It just doesn't work that way. Thirdly, what do I actually want to know? What was I going to ask them? Was it their life stories? Was it how they felt about the things that had happened to them? And again, relatedly, what questions should I ask? The right questions can unlock an interview, but it took weeks and months of trial and error to find those right questions. You can be surprised by how little you know about what you're actually asking. I spent the first few weeks of my fieldwork asking people, have you had any problems with the police? And it was weeks before I came to understand that they were all saying no because police violence had become so normalized. They didn't see being randomly stopped and searched, roughed up, harassed as problems. And that taught me as much as asking my original questions. So in the end, I did unstructured life story style interviews with about 50 young women. I found them by snowballing, which is just basically asking everyone you could find and moving from one contact to the next. And I asked them about everything. I asked them about their experiences of quinotarismo. I asked them about their families and educations, their political opinions, whether they considered themselves socialists, their dreams for the future, ideas about love and sex, and their experiences, obviously, with the police and other state institutions. I also did participant observation in bars, beaches, clubs, hotels, on the streets, to find out how this scene worked and what the cast of characters looked like, to find out how it felt, looked, sounded, and smelled to be there. I also did archival research around Cuba in various settings to be able to set my case against its backdrop, against histories of colonialism, religion, imperialism, revolution, and against the policies of the Cuban government and of the international system, international forces and diplomacy, all of which shaped the field I was looking at. And I did a couple of more formal interviews with state officials. Got to get their side of the story, too. So the Cubans I met and interviewed challenged beliefs about them. And those beliefs include things like that they're oppressed, that they're selfish, that they're frivolous, that they're promiscuous, that they're inconstant. But they also challenged my assumptions as a researcher. They challenged me to be reflexive and critical. So if some element of my approach wasn't working, a tactic, a tone, a question, a way of framing the whole project, when I talked about it to them, I changed it. I reworked it. And the upshot of all of this is that the questions I raised earlier never go away. They're never fully or finally answered, and that's okay. This taught me something about the nature of politics, about identity and categories, and how they do or don't work. And that's about politics. The point is to be open to the twists and turns in research. And my central research question was worked much the same way. It changed over and over again. Because ultimately what I found is that what's controlled through Cuba's regime of repression against the quinoteras isn't exploitation or violence or any objective form of harm. It's rather unacceptable romantic and sexual relationships, unacceptable to the government. And that raised questions for me about how we think about the body, and especially about women's bodies. What can they do? What is it understood that they should do? And equally, what is it permissible to do to them under certain circumstances? So in the end, my research question was fairly simple. How are bodies governed in Cuba? Or why are these bodies allowed to be governed so differently from other ones? And what does that tell us about the way that power works in Cuba? So quickly, before I let you go, I'm bringing this up towards the close, but this runs through an entire project. Even if your work never takes you away from your desk, it has an ethical impact. So while I was on field research, I had to think about safety, mine and my informants, privacy and their right to have identifying details removed, safe ways to store my recordings and my notes. But ethics is about more than those things. It's about a stance to research that includes things like not pressing people for information they're not happy to give me, taking on board my interviewees' concerns about the project or the topic and how they might feel about the finished project, considering who benefits from my research and from my argument. Considering ethical challenges and how to conduct and write up research in an ethical way was a major component of this process. It was a project that made many of the usual ethical steps impossible. The sensitive nature of the research meant I couldn't keep written records of their names, I couldn't be back in touch with them, I couldn't use consent forms, but that doesn't get me off the hook. And in fact, I'd argue it makes the responsibility greater. And then I have a last slide that I'm probably going to skip now about things that I learned. So there you go, you can read those. And we'll call it a day.
Hello everyone, and you can still read that while I'm talking because I don't have any slides. My name's Matthew Watson, I'm from the University of Warwick, although once upon a time I was Matthew Watson from the University of Birmingham when I worked here in Polsys. That is until they got rid of me, and then I became Matthew Watson from Warwick, which I still am. You will have sent round a paper that I asked to be distributed to all of you, my paper on Crusoe Friday, and I think I call it the raced the raced market frame of orthodox economics textbooks. And that's the paper that I want to talk about this morning by way of giving you a little bit of a background into the genesis of the way that I do my academic research. Hopefully, there will be some lessons that you can take home for your own research, but some of the things are likely to be specific to the stage of the career that I'm at. For instance, I was invited to write this piece for a special issue of the journal New Political Economy. I suspect that you probably won't have guest editors emailing you and asking you to write a piece. And I was asked to write this piece because of my current research, which is being funded by an ESRC professorial fellowship. And one of the books that I have to write as part of that research is on Robinson Crusoe and the effects of the Robinson Crusoe metaphor within the way in which orthodox economics is taught. Now, one of the things that happens when you get increasingly old, like I now am, is that you're given more and more latitude to write exactly what it is that you want to write. And certainly my professorial fellowship gives me that space and that ability to think almost semi-autobiographically. So it's those issues, those intellectual issues that I remember all the way back to when I was an economics student that continue to grab my attention and continue to tell me that they are interesting. And that is the research that I continue to do now. This might look as though it's all a little bit self-centred, that I'm writing at one level about me and about my experiences. But with a bit of luck, I can then tap into a number of arguments that allow that research to resonate rather more broadly. That's what I hope, anyway. One of my first experiences as an undergraduate student in the last century, when I was studying economics, was being given a book by Lawrence Boland, quite a famous book. It's called The Principles of Economics, and it has a really, really provocative subtitle. The subtitle is, Or the Lies That My Teachers Told Me. Now, I don't for one minute think that any of my economics lecturers told me lies, but I have been fascinated from when I was a student myself about the way in which economics is taught, the way in which there seemed to be a standard message about what economics was, what economics could be. And I was always quite surprised, I think, about how easily my teachers seemed to accept that standard argument and would reproduce it in front of me and the rest of my cohort. So a lot of my academic career, as I've moved from economics to politics departments, has been about trying to understand why that intellectual common sense has developed, why economics seems to be different to the way that we study politics. Now, I suspect that there are quite a few of you in the audience who are doing joint honours degrees and will spend half of their week in a politics department and half of their week in an economics department. And you might think that this is really rather tough. It's as if you have to divide yourself into two over the course of each week, because what you're being required to do as a politics student is rather different to what you're being required to do as an economics student. I had that same experience 20-odd years ago, and that's what continues to dominate a lot of my work. In particular, I was always struck about the significance of the Robinson Crusoe metaphor to the way that economics is taught. I had this inkling that economists needed to be able to put a name to their homo economicus figure, their rational economic man, and that Robinson Crusoe seemed to be the name that popped up in textbook after textbook after textbook. Even if it wasn't Robinson Crusoe named explicitly like that, it was somebody who was put into a Robinson Crusoe environment. And we learnt economics back in the 1990s through the adventures of this Robinson Crusoe figure. Increasingly, I've been given the space to think through those issues rather more systematically. And this has been a real eye-opener for me. In the first instance, it's taken me into some rather different literature that I've always considered myself to be a political economist. I've always taught political economy modules. I've always had jobs that have had political economy in the title. I still do. But working on Robinson Crusoe forced me to also become familiar with the literary criticism literature. And this was a real step into the unknown for me. And it did make me wonder what happens when you can put two completely different literatures into conversation with one another. And this might be a lesson that you can also take from my research about what it means about what it means to be an interloper, to go and study something from a different perspective, to break the shackles of being told that your degree programme can only be about one thing, and to begin to think rather more broadly about the subject matter that's in front of you. I found this wonderful. I discovered for a start that the Crusoe I learnt about as an economics student bears pretty much no resemblance whatsoever to the Crusoe that I discovered within Defoe's most famous novel. And this interested me because I thought I knew what that novel was all about. But I thought I knew what that novel was all about without ever having read it. And I wonder whether you're in the same position as well. If I was to ask each one of you to write down in two sentences what you think Daniel Defoe's novel Robinson Crusoe is about, you could do it, couldn't you? But how many of you actually read it? I would suspect very, very few. One person wonderfully volunteered the information that he has read it. I'm taking it from the fact that no other hands went up that the rest of you haven't. But Robinson Crusoe seems to be one of those novels that you don't have to read to know what's in it. It has a cultural life of its own, the story of the shipwrecked sailor trying to learn through a back-to-nature survivalism how to cope the best that he can. This is a story that resonates down the years. But it's also a story that's been systematically overwritten by contemporary novelists. I found myself reading contemporary novels over the last few years, and I've been able to call this work. It's absolutely wonderful. Usually, I have to read boring old academic texts that are written by people like me. But instead, I've been able to immerse myself in some of the most fundamental systematic rewritings of the Crusoe story. In particular, post-colonial and subsequently decolonial novelists have tried to disturb what the Crusoe and Friday metaphors mean. We all know that Crusoe and Friday are locked into a relationship. We all know the broad outlines of what that relationship is. And if we read Daniel Defoe's novel in its original form, it's as horrific as we think that it might be, and then probably some more on top of that. But post-colonial and decolonial novelists have tried to unwrite that relationship. They've tried to give Friday a particular voice. They've tried to undermine lots of the assumptions that Crusoe took for granted. They've tried to redress the power relationship that operates between them. And one of the things that has really struck me while doing this work is that there's probably only one place that's left where the Crusoe and Friday signifiers have not been rewritten, and that's within the pages of orthodox economics textbooks. They have their own Crusoe and Friday, but their Crusoe and Friday does absolutely nothing to try to challenge the historical circumstances in which Defoe felt he was able to write such a thoroughly colonial text. Defoe, remember, was writing in the era of George III, just as George III came to the English throne. He was known to most of the upper-class English gentlemen as German George. Guess what? Because he was from Germany. They were really good at nicknames in those days. And German George had to be told how to act like a true Englishman. Defoe thought that one of his jobs in writing the novel Robinson Crusoe was to tell German George what the English outlook on life was. The English outlook on life was to be ever more global. The colonial project was one that every true-born Englishman would seize and would seize with alacrity. This was what the story is all about. And one of the things that I tried to do in my work is to begin to understand what it means to take the characters, take the names of the characters from such a clear colonial story and present them in completely depoliticised ways within the framework of orthodox economics textbooks. Crusoe and Friday, as signifiers, represent racial hierarchy. They represent the logic of white subordination of black bodies. This is written so deeply into the story that it's impossible to unwrite that core element of it, except in economics textbooks. There, Crusoe and Friday are just two names of two distinct everymen, people who have exactly the same opportunities in life. They have formal equality when contracting in front of the law. They have formal equality within the imagined economic institutions in which they operate. Can we really, really, really believe that's true, though? If we look at the actual world, we know that market institutions are also likely to operate on distinctly racialized lines. There are racialized hierarchies of economic opportunity. However much they might be wished away, they are still sociologically with us. And that is an issue that economics textbooks have yet to address. In this imagined world of full equality, where Crusoe is just another everyman and Friday is just another Crusoe, then everyone looks exactly the same. So in conclusion, I think I've probably got about 30 seconds left. There is a big question underpinning all this, of course. You are IPE students, this is an IPE module. Is any of this IPE? I'm not sure, and I'm not even sure whether that matters. What I hope it does is raise some interesting questions about the way that we use economic concepts and about the way that those economic concepts were themselves produced in particular historical circumstances. Historical circumstances dominated by imperial struggles and the colonial economy. And if that's the only thing that this paper can do, and if that's the only thing that this style of work can do, then hopefully it still serves some sort of purpose anyway. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sophie Harman. I come from Queen Mary University in London, and I'm really happy to be here and to be invited here by Hugh. I don't know if Hugh told you, but we did our PhDs at the same time at the University of Manchester.
And
our masters. Yeah, sorry, Hugh. I rewrote our history to only focus on the good times, maybe. I don't know. So I remember Hugh when he was here in your lecture hall. There you go, see? What I'm going to do with my talk today is something a bit different. I'm going to be talking about a film I've produced. And before I'm going to tell you about film as method and how I came to that, I'm going to ask you all a question. And I want you to put up your hands if the answer to that question is yes. And the reason I'm explaining all this instead of asking the question is that there's not going to be a follow-up question, so be free. Because you know when you're in a lecture, you're like, well, I want to put my hand up, but what if they ask me a difficult follow-up question? No need, don't worry. So here's the question. How many of you are interested in or read anything about feminist international political economy? Ooh, well, okay, good. Right, so half and half. Now, half of you may not have done, because you're going to do that at the end of this term, because feminism is always put in week 10. Or you might do it because you're not very interested in it, because why would you be? This is international political economy, you want markets, trade, the other stuff. But those of you who have read some feminist international political economy will know that common to political economy, feminist political economy, are concerns of the care economy, informal labour, social reproduction, and then the big bugbear that goes everywhere is hidden women, hidden gender, the invisibility of women. These are debates that have been happening in feminist IPE and feminist international relations, feminist international development for about 30 years. Where are the women? Where are the women in policy? Where are the women in the discipline? Why do people not use gender as an analytical tool? And I never started my research doing an openly feminist political economy project. I've always been a feminist, I've always used a gender lens, but I was never, you know, I never kind of said, yo, I'm doing a feminist project, I'm going to feminist conferences. However, I have always asked myself, where are the women? And I've always thought to myself, why are women always invisible? And this has become more and more frustrating the more and more I do research. So I do research on the political economy of global health and the governance of global health. And I've done research in many different countries where I see women giving free care as a real part of global health initiatives, from HIV/AIDS to Ebola. So I started this project with the main question of how do you make women visible in international politics? How do you make women visible in global health? And my answer to that question was to make them visible in the biggest way possible, to put them on the biggest screen, the cinema screen. I was going to make a film about them. And that is where Pili came from. So, Pili is a film that's based on the lives and everyday experiences of women living with HIV in rural Tanzania. It's also based on the idea that it translates my research to wider audiences, but it also became a method of understanding international relations. And I'm going to tell you how I made Pili, the problems of making Pili, and actually what film tells you about research method and how it could be interesting. Now, you might be sitting here thinking, well, I mean, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to make a film, so I'm going to switch off for 10 minutes. But no, I'm also going to tell you how you can engage in the everyday practices. I know the everyday is really hip in IPE. How everyday practices that you engage in tell you something about power relations and how you might want to use that. So, what is Pili and what's it about? Now, this is the only bit I have to read because I forget this bit. To my mind, Pili is about the everyday risk of women living with HIV. It's about the informal economy. It's about social reproduction. It's about African agency. It's about health system strengthening. It's even about dangers of road traffic accidents. It's got everything in there. It's about micro-lending. So that's what I think it's about. Now, this is what we've got on IMDb. So this is what we want audiences to think about. Pili is about a woman living in rural Tanzania, working in the fields for less than $2 a day to feed her two children and struggling to manage her HIV-positive status in secret. When she is offered the chance to rent a sought-after market stall, Pili is desperate to have it. But with only 2 days to get the deposit together, Pili is forced to make increasingly difficult decisions with ever-deepening consequences. How much will she risk to change her life? Dun, dun, dun. And then the logline is 3 days to change your life. How much will you risk to do it? So that's what we want audiences to think it's about. Great. I mean, it sounds exciting, no? I mean, yeah, great. Okay, so how did I make Pili? So Pili is a feature-length drama. It's 80 minutes in length. It's not a documentary. Lots of people still in my university think I've made a documentary, so I'm quite shocked when I screened this last week. It is based on the lives of the women you see in the film. So me and the director who worked on the project interviewed 85 women from this region, the majority of whom were HIV positive, and we listened to all their stories. We then mashed all their stories together into the story of the film. Director Leanne Wellham then wrote the screenplay, and then we cast the film based on all the women who we met to tell the story. So everybody you see in the film is real. Never acted before, all at work in the fields, 65% of the cast are HIV positive. We only have one actor. So we only have one actor who's acted before, who's actually quite a famous actor in Tanzania. But other than him, everybody else, no acting experience whatsoever. They are now back working in the fields in their everyday lives. So that's the cast. The crew is a combination of Tanzanian crew and crew from the UK as well. So we were a stripped back crew. There was a director of photography. That's why it looks so good. Like, I didn't do that. A camera assistant, sound guy, and then a couple of production assistants. Excuse me, I've got, like everybody, a cold, but we'll keep going. All the locations you see are real, so we were able to film in functioning care and treatment units for people living with HIV, real hospitals, the real field. So everything that you see on screen is real, except for the one actor. But everyone else is real, and they're acting a part. The reason we wanted to make a drama rather than a documentary is because of audience. More people go and watch dramas than they do documentaries. More people in East Africa go and watch dramas than they do documentaries. The people in the film would never go and watch a documentary. They would find it boring. A drama engages people in different ways, and it allows you to present very difficult issues in different forms. There's also an ethical reason of how to make it a drama. We had to show that these women were not playing their lives, but were playing a part. So that Bello, who plays Pili, Bello Rashid, people, when they watched Pili, they didn't think that she was Pili. We're like, no, 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 Pili is a fictional character. Even though her character is drawn from these lives of these 85 women, she is a fictional character. So we wanted to make that distinction clear. Because normally when you do a research project, you make your participants anonymous. I mean, often. You can't make someone anonymous when they're up on the screen. So that's kind of what we did. That's how we made it. I oversaw all the post-production. So my role was a producer and co-writer. I mean, I was like, I don't really know what I'm doing. I just seem to be doing everything. And then also we had the whole kind of edit process. I know how to do a music licensing agreement because we've got some Bongo Flavor stars on the soundtrack. You're like, what is she talking about? Bongo Flavor, if you don't know, is Tanzanian hip-hop. It's very big, okay? Biggest star is Diamond. Platinums, we didn't get diamonds. But we did get Shah, who's amazing. So everyone go on YouTube. Yeah, you three are like, who is she? What is she talking about? Anyway, you should all listen to Shah. So, when you start making a film, you can't really see this, everybody thinks, or everybody in my department thinks, it's all of this. You're going to be going around with the board or the clapper, and it's all going to be fun, and you're making a film. Isn't that great? My head of school went, oh, everybody wants to make a film. And, you know, you think you're just going to be hugging all the women in the film, and everyone's going to think it's wonderful. Not true. This is to be one of the most unpleasant periods of my research life that I have ever had. It's been a difficult process. If you make a film, or when I made Pilly, I should say, it involved government bureaucracy like you would never know. So the government of Tanzania has taken $2,000 of my research grant, numerous photocopies of paperwork, yet never gave me a film permit. But I made the film anyway, what can I say? Yeah, I'll just gloss over that. I can talk to you more about that. It's in the paper I also circulated. I don't know if Hugh circulated to you, but you can read all about that lovely episode. Also involved an extortion attempt by someone who was working with me. Also involved local government corruption with immigration. My detention at Dar es Salaam Airport when trying to leave the country. That was a happy moment as well. Death. We had three deaths. And one funeral. Two people got malaria. Everyone had a bit of a funny tummy bug at some point. So it wasn't easy, and it was quite difficult. And the whole time through it, I was thinking, why am I doing this? You know, I've got quite a cushy job. I don't need this in my life. You know, this was meant to be fun. You know, it was meant to be more this. Me walking around with the board going, yeah, action. That doesn't happen. I'm not allowed to say that. That's the director. But then I got back and I started to think about it. So in the process when we finished the main shoot, which was 5 weeks in Tanzania, I started to try and make sense of it. And I started to realise that actually the doing of the making of the film was much more revealing than any research I've ever done before. So I've done, I would say, about 270 interviews in Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, Sierra Leone, World Bank in Washington, WHO in Geneva. If you want to ask me questions about interviews, that's fine. So I've done all that. I've done the participant observation of community group meetings and government meetings. And I know a lot. I knew a lot about the Tanzanian state. I lecture on Africa and international relations, so I know about bureaucracy and patronage and issues like that. But when you're encountering it and you're doing it, it actually reveals much more. It told me something about the relationship between trust and the state, which I know trust is very big in Birmingham, because this is where Nick Wheeler works. So a little plug for Nick. It also told me about my own international feminism. You know, I thought I'd be there. Actually, I didn't. I thought, you know, I'd be working, be co-produced research. The women would, you know, maybe resist or be interested. All the women were very, very supportive of the project. But of course, they see me. I am money. I was paying them a small fee every day to do the project. This picture here is from 2 weeks ago in Tanzania when I screened the film, these two, screened the film in Tanzania. And of course, they were lovely. They were like, wow, this is really great, this is exciting, but okay, where do you have some money for us? Because, you know, fair enough, life's hard. So there was always going to be a financial transaction relationship. It also made me reflect on issues of race and class as well. Because when you go and do interviews, you sort of have that formal, I'm Dr. Harmon, here's my business card, I come from the University of London, that has a certain cachet of kind of wealth and power. If you go to Tanzania and you're called a Mzungu, so that's a white person, you're there, that also has this idea of, well, no one's going to give you any bother because you're a Mzungu. Now, that might be the case if you're doing interviews. But if you're actually trying to make something, that doesn't count for anything. So that has a very interesting dynamic also with the relationship between the crew member who did try and extort money from me. So this has made me reflect on all these different processes, as well as the issues of aesthetics and IR, and ethics and all that type of stuff, which I'm also happy to talk about in the Q&A. So why does this matter for you? Like I say, why are you thinking, well, yeah, this is all very well, but I don't have a nice research grant to make a film, or maybe you do. Well, it kind of made me think that actually, if we study international political economy, we always seem to do it as a step removed. You know, we always sort of like think through our research questions, we remove it. We never put ourselves in it. And that's maybe, like Matt says, I'm sort of a bit further on in my career so I can think about my own interests and my position and take some risks in this sense. But you practice international politics and international political economy every day. You could do research looking at what happens with where the University of Birmingham invests at your tuition fees. You could look at the relationship between the student union supporting, say, food banks in the local area and how your engagement with that works. You could think about commissioning groups in your local NHS and how you engage. You are practicing these things all the time. So you could actually look at that. Now, my warning is don't do bad autoethnography. So there's one thing to say, oh, yes, I'm practicing international relations. I can structure my own dissertation on that. But just say, well, yes, I talked to a student. They were an international student, and this is what happened, the end. You're looking, you still want to plan it in a kind of systematic way. You do want to plan it as a proper research project as well. Some autoethnography I have problems with because it's all about, I met someone poor and then I felt terrible. And, you know, Pilly was never meant to be about that. It's meant to be about the women in the film. So I'm very nervous about doing that. And you should be too. All right? So think about, if you do want to do this kind of practical aspect of practicing international relations as a research project, think it through like you would any other research project. And on that, I may end, but just to note that, yes, making film was a right pain, but now, you know, you get to enjoy it. If you ever want to know anything more about Pilly, you can follow @PillyFilm on Twitter. She's on IMDb, and we can update you if we get into a film festival for next year. All right, thank you very much.
Yes, we've got about 10 minutes. Questions could be about anything that was said or not said, you know. Show of hands. We can maybe take a few questions. Don't feel shy about asking questions, right? I know it's big lecture theatre, etc., but these guys are used to this kind of thing. This is what we usually do at academic conferences. People speak, and then we kind of throw questions at them, criticism, comments, etc. So don't feel shy about asking more questions. Maybe we'll take two or three questions together and then give them a chance to respond. Any hands?
Why don't you show them how it's done then?
Yeah, you do it.
I wanted to know, because I'm going to take up time otherwise.
I'm going to write my dissertation on ESG models, and I've read your book on that. Do you have any novels you can suggest that I might read that might make that a bit clearer?
I can answer that in 30 seconds, Hugh, if I can.
Sure.
I would recommend any novel possible as light relief from having to parent the dynamics, the general equilibrium literature. Not a lot of fun, the technical side of it. I suspect that maybe novels that focus on scientific utopias, because that is what the DSG model is, really. But it's one of those interesting scientific utopias that's been accepted as an authoritative account of the world. And has effects on that basis.
Yeah, okay,
so if you were to think about it that way, then it maybe does open up scope for additional research by looking at what the tradition of positing a scientific utopia is and how that might have effects within economic policy.
Okay, someone's taken the first lead on it.
How do you think nations should incorporate gender into their foreign policies?
Is that a question for someone?
Both of you, or anyone?
Right. Should we take a couple of other ones now we're on the roll, and then we'll give them a chance to speak, otherwise I'll have to come off here.
It's more targeted toward the movie. Did you, and it's a twofold question, is your target audience in Tanzania and developing countries, or in England as like lobbying and advocacy? And secondly, if it was based in Tanzania and developing countries, did you have a hard time making it accessible for people because it is a movie? Yeah.
Great. And one more.
Go on. Just for theory, really. In terms of like choosing what research to do, did you like encounter an individual case that got you interested in a wider topic, or was it an interest in a wider topic that led you into like a specific case?
But can I just, before they answer, one of the hardest things in the world for an academic is giving a short answer, because we just love talking about stuff we do because no one ever asks about it, no one ever cares. If I could just ask you maybe to pick one or so questions and answer it briefly, that would be great. Thank you. Julia, first.
Okay, so I'll speak to the foreign policy question. My general area is gender and security, so when I hear foreign policy, I think security, so I'm going to talk about that, and I hope it's what you meant. Obviously, there's a lot of ways we'd be thinking about the way different foreign policies affect women differently from men, but I think in terms of a wider mindset to go into thinking about security, we need to have a broader notion of what counts as security, a broader notion of what counts as peace. Because the violence that you know affects women in particular tends to stretch a lot past the boundaries of what we call peace and conflict. So can we really say that we're at peace if women are still subjected to all kinds of interpersonal, domestic violence, forms of sexual violence, all the different things, forms of precarity in their lives? Broadening out the notion of what we're seeking when we seek peace, I think, is a really good part of how you can have a potentially one view of a feminist foreign policy.
Matt, do you
want to
go next?
Mm-hmm.
Brief.
Let me say something about the issue of audience, because I think this is really interesting. And there is a wider point, isn't there, about the audience that academics write to. And I think that might change over time. If you're being pressurised to try to find a way of convincing people to give you a job, then I think that you write in a specific way for a specific audience with specific target journals in mind. When you are fortunate enough to have your feet under the table of a permanent post, then you can be more self-indulgent. And I think you can write with broader audiences in mind. And that might be one thing to bear in mind when you're reading academic work. What stage of career is the academic at, and who are they trying to write for? One of the things that's always struck me is that, and I think this is the same for you as well, that you can be an important part of your own audience, that you should always write something that has an intrinsic meaning to you. It should be able to speak to the concerns that are particularly important for you. I think that Hugh will thank you very much if you write in a way and write on topics that encapsulate something about you as an individual, something about your political outlook on life, rather than trying to write the perfect academic essay that doesn't take a position on anything. I'm sure he would really, really rather that you wrote in a way that reveals something about you within your text.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay, so quick answer to the gender and foreign policy question, which would be huge. Firstly, how does this policy impact on men and women differently? How is it going to reproduce gender stereotypes, if at all, and exacerbate the problem? Quick answer. It's more complex bit than that. On the audience question, so the planned audience is a worldwide audience. Our plan is for it to be in a film festival in North America or Europe in the new year, and the reason why is because that's the economics of filmmaking, is you get it into a film festival, that's where distributors are. Distributors buy the film and then they sell it to independent cinemas, and we're going to try and sell the film because all the money goes back to the women in the film. Now, it has been screened in Tanzania because you made a right point, because who goes to the cinema in Tanzania? Nobody. So 2 weeks ago, I did show it to 500 people in a football field in this local town, and everything was amazing. People were filming it on their phones, which is always a good sign. So it's already been bootlegged, wonderful.
But long term, what we're going to try and do is, I had a meeting with the Tanzanian government, the Tanzanian Commission for AIDS, TACAIDS, about funding a tour of Pili around Tanzania. So we're just going to go and set up mobile cinemas like we did. If it takes off and it's a really great success, what we'll also do is maybe work with a mobile phone provider to cut it up into small pieces. So the audience is worldwide, and when the director and I made it, we actually wanted the audience to be like our mums. Because when you make do-gooding films or do-gooding documentaries, they're always pitched to Claire, age 38, lives in North London, has two kids, reads The Guardian and reads the Daily Mail when she feels a bit guilty about it. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to have much more appeal. Oh, poor Claire. I don't know who this fictional Claire is. That's the kind of archetype. And then the individual case, wider topic. So this project, I have been working in the field of HIV and global health since I started my PhD. So, yeah. I don't know, 2004, did we start that huge? We're still so young. And I think what happened was the actual project was meant to be an impact project. It was meant to be telling a story about my research and impacting it to wider audiences. It became something so much more when we switched it. So sometimes you can have a general big topic, and then you can start to do some reading around, as you all will, and then that's how you narrow. So you sometimes do that practically, if you've got the liberty and the time to do it, or you do it through reading around. But you always start with the big, kind of, here's some interesting questions. And I'm sure all your supervisors will say, focus, focus, focus. But the fun of it's the reading around and working it out and the big things. But yeah, always start with.
Conscious, would anyone with one last burning question? If not, it's probably need to wrap up. I think the thing that I would emphasise before I thank the speakers is we're at that stage now for the 7 years of narrowing things down, and I hope you can take those two key points away. Number one, think of something like Matt said, you know, and these are great examples, things that, you know, I thought Megan's point earlier on, things that interest you, things that disturb you about the world, right? So when you're writing your case studies, don't just pick something kind of, you know, abstract out there. You've lived through things, you see this all the time. Pick something that's personal, number one. And number two, these are great examples of how to narrow down, how to think and, you know, sift through the literature, whatever it is, and try to focus on a particular thing. But can I just thank our guest speakers for a great session today.
The brother.